In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc., and you.
She may have had to commit chemical warfare against her own body to temporarily chemically sterilize herself so that she can have her position as a news broadcaster or as an elected official.
I'm a Christian today, Todd, not because it works for me. That's the last reason. There are many days when it doesn't even seem to work for me. There's many days when I wish I could take a shortcut like I used to when I was a non-believer. I'm a Christian today because it is true.
The experience isn't going to save. What's going to save is that word of forgiveness that Christ died even for you in your lowest point.
I jokingly called this the Issues Etc. Revolution, the near complete sweeping out of the old guard that emphasized church growth practices down the line.
Many Protestant Christians today, especially in America, regard government as a necessary evil, as something that works against the purposes of God and against the purposes of the church in the world, wherever it's found. And if it is good government, which you, in the opinion of many Protestants, you rarely find, if it's good government, it's still at its heart opposed to God's purposes, especially with regard to the church. Now, is that, given that mindset among many Protestants, is that in keeping with the Protestant Reformation, in particular with the political thought of 16th century reformer Martin Luther? Many Protestants might be surprised to discover that Luther regarded temporal authority, whether it be in government at any level or all the kinds of temporal authority that we find around us, as a divine gift, as a holy order. Now, some people will say, didn't Luther teach a two kingdoms theology? Isn't that kind of the same thing as the separation of church and state? Well, that's a good question. We'll be answering that question in the course of this first hour of Issues, etc. Some people have laid another political event at Luther's doorstep. They say he and his thought led to the rise of fascism and National Socialism. Is there any weight to that argument? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the political thought of Martin Luther according to his political writings, and there are many of those, by the way. He writes from a theological perspective, but it has political ramifications. Dr. Jarrett Carty will be our guest for the first hour of Issues Etc. A little bit later, Pastor Tom Baker will join us. We're going to be in Luke chapter 10, beginning at verse 25. The famous parable of the Good Samaritan. I guess my first question for Tom will be, when we get him on in here in hour two, is that's a good title for this parable? Sometimes the titles of the parables will mislead us and cause us to misread those parables. We'll deal with that in hour two of Issues, etc. Stay tuned, because a little bit later, we are going to be giving away two copies of our Issues, etc. book of the month for July, called Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, The Political Writings of Martin Luther. We'll be giving away two copies of those. Call in number 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. You can send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Jarrett Carty is associate professor in the Liberal Arts College of Concordia University, Montreal, Quebec, Canada. He's author of the Issues Etc. book of the month for July, Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, The Political Writings of Martin Luther. Dr. Carty, welcome to Issues, etc.
Oh, thanks very much. Glad to be here.
There's a quote that is often attributed to Luther popularly. I've never been able to track down its real source or whether it's just apocryphal with regard to Luther. Something to the effect of, "I'd rather be ruled by a wise Turk than a foolish Christian." Have you ever come across this with authentic attribution to Luther himself?
That does sound quite familiar, actually, and I'm trying to just off the top of my head remember where that is, but there's something to that effect that he makes. I guess if I had to take a guess, which I'll do, it would be in a writing like On the War Against the Turk. But Luther said a lot of things in a lot of different places, so I could be wrong, but it does have a very familiar ring to it, and it actually would make some sense given his political thought.
So it does accurately represent his thought with respect to whether or not rulers ought to be Christian exclusively.
That's right. Actually, Luther differed from several of his fellow reformers like Philip Melanchthon and Johannes Brenz, who were contemporaries and fellow evangelical German reformers, in that he believed that government was government, regardless of whether it was Christian or not. And he got this from the Bible. He got this from 1 Peter and in Romans, both the apostles, the authors of, or the authorities of these letters say that you ought to respect, honor, and obey the temporal authorities over you. And in those cases, in both Peter and Paul's case, that was the Roman emperor, who by no means at that point was a Christian.
What did Luther mean when, and this, you kind of have to wait, and you say in your book, until you get Luther's slightly more mature thought on the political order, the civil realm. What did he mean when he referred to temporal government as a holy order?
That's a great question, and it's a big question for Luther. There is this idea that in readings, a writing like Temporal Authority, which is the go-to text for Luther's thought on the matter, as if that he's only talking about, narrowly speaking, political things. But he, in fact, means the governance of the entire world, so including marriage, including social order, including schools, these kinds of things. And so it's a much wider thing for Luther to talk about it as a holy order. He means it's something like the way in which God's order and goodness governs the entirety of life. And in that respect, it's not as narrow as just thinking of, say, magistrates or those we elect or those that rule over us, but something much, much grander and much bigger. And that is all for the betterment of our lives and living in our lives peaceably with one another to God and to the natural world.
Is it as general as kind of the Reformed view of providence?
I'm not sure that it is quite as general as that, because there are specifics of how that order. He makes a distinction, just to back up a little bit, he does make a distinction later in his thought between three holy orders and the two governments that he talked about in earlier writings, like in Temporal Authority. And while at first glance it might look that he's correcting himself or changing his mind, or maybe even contradicting himself, I actually think that the two ideas are complementary, because temporal order included, in the way he described it, in the two kingdoms, included marriage, which he calls a third holy order in later thinking. But I think that they're complementary. Providence, yes, in the sense in which by our best use of reason, by natural law, by the world of nature, and by our own wisdom acquired, we can come to know how we ought to govern ourselves in this world. And that's distinct from spiritual and revealed truths that Luther clearly gets from the Bible or from directly from God and by some means.
For Luther, what was the divine purpose of temporal government?
To sum it up simply, I think he thinks that it's what we might call law and order. That is, keeping order, curbing sin, and directing us to live lives that not only keep us fed, keep us healthy, keep us safe, but also give for the ground to spiritual revelation. That is, to make the world safe for the spiritual truths that the Bible and God gives to us. So they're complementary, but they're separate for Luther, so that the temporal kingdom, the order in the temporal kingdom, is complementary to the spiritual. And so that when things are going well in that civil temporal order, we are open to the spiritual truths of by grace alone and so forth, but to God's salvation. So he sees them as being separate, but at the same time, they're complementary.
Did he see a need for reform, reformation, obviously in the spiritual realm, obviously in the church? Did he see a need for reformation of a sort in the temporal realm?
I think he did, and I think that this is something that is not as clearly appreciated or understood today. And in part, that's because, of course, as you say, he was obviously a church reformer, and that was his the bulk of his career. But he saw, just because of that complimentary I was just speaking of, he saw at the same time that there was a kind of, if I can use the term, reformation of the political order as well. Now, there's not a whole lot of evidence that Luther was terribly interested or even terribly well-read on the history of political thought in the Middle Ages. At the same time, however, we do see that what he thinks he's doing is renewing political order and putting it back onto the place of honor and respect that he believed the apostles thought. And in that respect, then, I think you can say that, yeah, indeed, he saw that what he was doing was a kind of political reformation at the same time, reviving the place, the divine place, or the divinely instituted place of political authority. And that's closely connected to his church reform, because he thought that the political order had become subservient to church authority. And actually, there's a very strong history of that being the case in the Middle Ages, that we see conflict between church authority and civil authority. This is really a sum up of a good 1,500 years of medieval Latin history, is this conflict. And it's a conflict that culminates in the papacy and the medieval church claiming to be supreme and having supreme authority over the civil realm. And Luther wants to correct that because he sees that as being not apostolically and biblically grounded, that there is a kind of independence, and I don't mean independence in that there is no God over civil authority, because that's not how Luther saw it at all, but that rather there is no human authority over politics, no spiritual authority, human-centered spiritual authority over the political realm.
Dr. Jarrett Carty is our guest. We're talking about the political thought of Martin Luther on this Tuesday afternoon, July the 16th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. When we come back, what was the prevailing view of temporal authority that Luther was, at least in part, responding to? Stay tuned. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Mount Zion Lutheran, Greenfield, Wisconsin. Pilgrim Lutheran, West Bend, Wisconsin. Messiah Lutheran, Lebanon, Illinois. Zion Lutheran, Accident, Maryland. Redeemer Lutheran, Jackson, Wyoming. Messiah Lutheran, Marysville, Washington. Trinity Lutheran, Millstadt, Illinois. Our Savior Lutheran, Houston, Texas. St. Matthew's Lutheran, Bon Terre, Missouri. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Lincoln, Nebraska. Hope Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Trinity Lutheran, Austin, Texas. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Collinsville, Illinois. Luther Memorial Chapel, Shorewood, Wisconsin. Christ Lutheran, Oak Park, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran, Naperville, Illinois. And Emmanuel Lutheran, Dearborn, Michigan. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Dr. Jarrett Cardy of Concordia University, Montreal, Quebec, Canada, and author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, the Political Writings of Martin Luther, about the political thought of the 16th century reform. It's Tuesday afternoon, July the 16th. Dr. Cardy, go into a little more detail on the subject we were addressing before the break. How would you describe the prevailing view of political thought at Luther's time of temporal authority that Luther was at least in part addressing?
Well, there's a great deal of tension that we see in this period outside of Luther's own thinking. I think there's a lot of evidence for it. Just to give an example of how there is something deeply problematic about what the temporal realm is as opposed to the church. So we see, for example, contemporary to Luther, lots and lots of examples of mirror of princes literature. So how to be a good prince, how to be a good ruler. And two greatly contrasting, but I think really insightful examples of this would be Erasmus's Education of the Christian Prince and Machiavelli's The Prince. They're contrasting in many ways because, of course, Erasmus's Education of the Christian Prince moves the prince towards being a good Christian in Erasmus's version of that. Whereas in Machiavelli, famously, of course, and I'm sure many of the listeners have some idea of Machiavelli's teachings, to be Machiavellian is to be somehow sneaky or bad in common parlance. But Machiavelli's version of what a good prince is someone who appears to be good, but in fact knows when to do the wrong thing, or what the commonly accepted view of the wrong thing is. And I think what that tells us about that era is that there is a kind of crisis of thinking of what exactly temporal order is, where it gets its authority. And this is, of course, long before later modern ideas of authority coming from the ground up, coming from the people, although there is something to that in the Middle Ages, too, with the conciliar movement. But I think it's indicative of Luther's age, that there is a kind of crisis here. And at the same time, there's a kind of crisis of church authority, so that the claims of both church and civil authorities to have kind of worldly power or world dominance, I guess I should say, really, in fact, is not lived out. So that, for example, in Luther's age, the Holy Roman Emperor is really reigns over the largest empire, the most populous empire in the history of the world. But it's also the most complicated, so that authority can't actually be effectively put into place. That Luther's a great example of this. Luther survives being banned by the church, condemned by the church, and condemned by the empire, and lives out his natural life. And he does so because his prince protects him. And his prince protects him over and against the authority of the empire and of the papacy. That alone should tell us that there's a problem with the claims of the emperor and the pope to be supreme and to have supreme power. And so I think that this period of European history is a really interesting one because it's this transitional period of finding new ground for temporal authority, or I guess more appropriately for how Luther thought about it, going back to the biblical version of that in his interpretation. And if we see with Erasmus and Machiavelli, other kinds of ways to retrieve what authority was, looking back to classics, looking back to what the ancients saw, which Luther, by the way, also advocated. So it's not simply about Romans or First Peter, in which both these epistles tell us to obey and to submit and to honor the authorities over us, but he also sees that there's great value in what, say, the classical Greeks or the classical Latin literature tells us about temporal authority as well. Famously Cicero, that Luther, according to the Table Talk deathbed note, or his deathbed message, was that, of course, his emphasis is on the Bible, but I think it's on point here, that he says if you want to learn the Bible, you have to have two lifetimes, meaning that it's beyond any person. If you want to learn politics, read Cicero, and that is within our grasp. And so it shows that Luther wasn't just about the theology and interpretation of the Bible, but that there were truths that were also reflected in our own reasoning and in human history that were complementary or identical to some of the political lessons that we get from the apostles.
Luther was obviously familiar with much of Erasmus. There's no doubt about that.
That's right.
The Prince was not published, I don't believe, in Latin until 1532. Is there any evidence that Luther ever laid eyes on that very influential political tome?
No, there is no evidence for that. At least it doesn't exist yet. If it's not, maybe it will be uncovered at some point. I can't imagine that characters like Melanchthon didn't at some point come across Machiavelli. And so that's a question of his contemporaries, whether they knew of him or not. I can't see how he wouldn't have, because Machiavelli does make a pretty big splash, even though he's dead. The Prince makes a pretty big splash fairly quickly. We do have evidence the other way around, where Machiavelli is aware of Luther. And that comes to us by way of Guicciardini, his contemporary and friend, who talks about Luther and the German Reformation, actually in quite favorable terms, because like many Italians, like Guicciardini, they're also very anti-clerical. So we do have evidence that way, but we don't have evidence on the Luther side that he would have, that he read or knew of Machiavelli. However, I do think that there, despite that lack of evidence, that there is something indicative in the way in which Luther writes Temporal Authority, Machiavelli writes The Prince, that it speaks to an era that's yearning for, searching for new or new old grounds for what the basis of temporal authority is and how political power ought to act.
Now, you mentioned before, you said that Luther's concern was that temporal authority had become subservient to church authority. Describe this. What's the main problem that Luther perceives when he begins to address issues of temporal authority?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's a complicated answer. But the simple version of it would be that then there's messiness in the details. I'll say a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But get to the simple version of it would be that having any kind of church authority over temporal power skews and derails the purpose of what temporal power is, and so it puts it on to so easily goes off the rails onto some other path that will lead to destruction for Luther. So the examples of that would be in his own lifetime. And immediately in his consideration of the matters would be radical politics of the radical reformers. This would be something like the Peasants' Revolt or the attempt in the city of Munster in the early 1530s to institute a new political rule on strict biblical and spiritual principles. For Luther, the mistake that this made was to turn temporal order into a spiritual order, and to the detriment of both. And for him, this leads to destruction. At least destruction of the temporal order, and it obscures the revelation of God. The other political problem is, in a sense, going the other direction from the radicals to what he sees as the problem with Rome, and that is to have church authority rather than being radical, but being conservative in a sense of not changing, but not seeing that the spiritual order has been corrupted by temporal power being assumed by the papacy. Luther sees himself between these two wings, between these two extremes, I guess you could say, and errors, in his opinion, of the radical politics on one side and the Roman church's dominance of politics on the other side.
I want to talk in a few minutes about Luther's response to the radical reformers, because there's a lot of stuff there. But Luther, as you mentioned early on, did have very solid biblical principles, so to speak. He had biblical foundations explicitly laid out when he addresses the issue of temporal authority. What did Luther find there?
What Luther sees, and I think actually this is something that is important for us in our day and age of how the Bible was understood and still indeed is understood today, but how this can sometimes be obscured in the way in which certain kinds of appropriations of the Bible see everything as being kind of equivalent, that you can find it in the Bible, it has biblical sanction. That's not how Luther saw the Scripture, that he saw Scripture as being the vehicle for the gospel, and the gospel was not the gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but the message of salvation that comes to us by grace alone, and all the teachings that went around with that. And that's why he prioritized Romans and epistles like the Petrine epistles, so 1 Peter in particular. And what he saw in them is that at the same time in which you have this theology of the gospel and the freedom that the gospel gives us by God's grace, also has with it certain kinds of ethical teachings that, while themselves are not, directly speaking, spiritual, have their kind of complementarity in the world. And so that means for him obeying government in general, honoring government in general, regardless of whether these are Christian or not, although there are exceptions to this, of course. There are problems with that because there can be political authorities that demand things that are to go contrary to the gospel, and that's where, for Luther, political authority can be limited, and one can have a kind of limited resistance against them. But for him, he saw then his political teachings as being grounded in the most clear statements of gospel faith in the Bible, and that's Paul's letter to the Romans, and especially 1 Peter. And, of course, these are formative parts of the Bible for Luther's own thinking in the Reformation. So prior to the Reformation controversy from 1517 on, in the years previous to 1517, which, of course, is the year of the publication of the 95 Theses, often thought to be the beginning of the Reformation, Luther lectured on Paul's letter to the Romans in 1513 to 1515. It's a very formative time for Luther's thought. And just prior to publishing Temporal Authority, he has a lecture series on 1 Peter that gets transcribed into published commentary. It's actually featured, a small excerpt of which is featured in the book. And the important thing is, again, to see that for Luther, the gospel message also comes along with it certain kinds of ethical teachings of how we should act in the world. And so for Luther, I think it's best to see this as being complementary to the gospel, not essentially the gospel itself. And that would be his distinction with the radicals, that the radicals blur the gospel and the ethical teachings about how we ought to act in the world. And for Luther, therefore, his doctrine, his ideas of temporal authority have biblical sanction. And not only that, but they're complementary to the gospel.
When we come back, we're going to address something that's often raised in that vein. And that is an apparent conflict. The ethos, so to speak, of the gospel is well known. Love your enemy. Do not return evil for evil. Turn the other cheek. And yet, government is instituted precisely for not doing those things, for protecting from the enemy, even taking life, for punishing the evildoer and all kinds of wickedness in this world. Is this a conflict? Was this a conflict for Luther? And if it was, how did he resolve it in his political thought? Dr. Jarrett Carty is our guest. It's Tuesday, July the 16th. We're talking about the political thought of 16th century reformer Martin Luther. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Did Martin Luther's political writings lead to the freedom of conscience, the separation of church and state, and German totalitarianism? Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, the political writings of Martin Luther is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month. You can read an excerpt at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Divine Kingdom, Holy Order by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, the political writings of Martin Luther.
This is Pastor Jeff Siegel of St. Mary Evangelical Lutheran Church in Des Moines, Iowa, where God gathers us around his means of grace to offer us forgiveness, life, and salvation. Whether you are looking for a church or just visiting Des Moines, if you like Issues Etc., St. Mary's is the church for you. Join us as we gather together every Sunday to continue the Reformation tradition of Christ-centered, cross-focused worship, preaching, and teaching. For more information, go to www.stmarylutheran.org. Remember to spell out Saint.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe the traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Does your church need a backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
St. Paul's Parish in Washington, D.C. with the hymn Abide With Me, playing right now on our 24/7 sacred music station, Lutheran Public Radio. Here's what a listener in Greenville, South Carolina wrote this weekend about LutheranPublicRadio.org. Love the music. I listen to it on iTunes Radio. That's just one of the places it's available. He says, "You are one of only a handful of religious stations that play traditional classical Christian music. Thanks for not bowing to the masses who would rather be entertained with contemporary Christian music and have forgotten that there is almost 2,000 years of Christian heritage represented in music available to edify the soul." Well, thanks for listening in South Carolina. That's what you will hear at LutheranPublicRadio.org 24/7, all free, anytime. Sacred music for the world. It's the church's music following the course of the church year. LutheranPublicRadio.org. We're talking about the political thought of Martin Luther. Dr. Jarrett Carty is our guest, associate professor in the Liberal Arts College of Concordia University in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for July, Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, The Political Writings of Martin Luther. Picking up where you left off there, Dr. Carty, is there an apparent conflict? The ethos, so to speak, of the gospel, well-known, love your enemy, do not return evil for evil, turn the other cheek, and yet temporal authority, according to Luther, is designed to punish evil in order to punish the evildoer in particular. You call that an apparent conflict that Luther was able to resolve.
That's right. Well, I'm reminded, this is a matter that comes up actually when I teach, and I'm always reminded by what I think is a great but telling line from the Coen brothers movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where I can't remember the character's name, but he's baptized in the river and thinks that he's now free from the temporal punishments of the state of Mississippi, and that it's not the same thing, that we're speaking of our relation to God, and indeed has some kind of deep relationship to the world, but you still owe things to, in the case of the character from the movie, the state of Mississippi. And I think this is how Luther sees this as well, that one can love one's neighbor by upholding law and order. And in fact, that often has to be the case. On the other hand, spiritually, that we are freed by the gospel to having those kinds of issues interfering with our reception of the grace of God. And so many people accuse Luther, many good scholars and contemporary scholars accuse Luther as bringing us to a kind of dualism in which we're free in one sense but not in another. And I don't think it's quite so fair to talk about that as an ethical dualism without seeing that, in fact, this is often the way we do live and often the way we do understand, that there are distinctions between things, that we may be free in one respect, but that also means we have to be controlled in another. Even politically, we do that. We have to be tempered to be free. And I think that for Luther, the key distinction is to keep the gospel pure, to see that God's grace comes to us alone, by itself, from God, not on our own merit. But at the same time, this doesn't mean that we are freed from the duties and obligations to one another. And in fact, that those things, while seeming to be a contradiction, are not. Luther resolves the issue of loving your neighbor or turning the cheek, going the extra mile, by saying that these are meant to help us understand God's grace. But even Jesus himself, at least by omission in many respects, in many instances of the gospel, upholds, say, for example, Roman military authority. Doesn't tell the centurion to leave his job, but respects his authority, in fact. And even the famous gospel story about the coin and the coin to Caesar, and give unto Caesar what is Caesar and what is to God's God's. Luther takes that to heart here and sees that these are complementary, but they're distinct. And so the contradiction is if we think that they're not.
Now, I want to back up and kind of break something down a little bit. You mentioned earlier three holy orders. Among them, the one you did mention explicitly was marriage. What are the three holy orders for Luther as they're set within that context of temporal and spiritual authority?
The primary source for Luther's thought on the matter are his lectures on the Book of Genesis in the last decade of his life, and there we find Luther speaking of these three orders, sometimes translated into English as three estates, and the one would be the spiritual order, the spiritual estate, the temporal or the political order, political estate, and the order of marriage. And as I said, in temporal authority and in early writings, there's a kind of overlap or an inclusion of marriage within the temporal order. But he distinguishes the three in his lectures on Genesis. And I think in the lectures on Genesis, which happened over 10 years, as I said, in the last 10 years of his life, I think we see Luther seeing more of an important, especially pastoral, distinction to make between marriage and all of temporal authority. That has a kind of exceptional status within the ways and the laws of the world. And that's why I think that he distinguishes them, or at least a major part of why he distinguishes them. I also think that he sees that as being distinguished in the Bible under his interpretation of Genesis. What's interesting about the matter of marriage in Luther's context is, of course, that there's a tension as to how to understand marriage, whether it's in the spiritual or whether it's in the temporal. And Luther pushes it more towards the temporal. Not that there isn't, of course, spiritual side, not that, of course, that it isn't in the natural order of things to marry and to have children and so forth, but that he sees this as being more of a responsibility of the temporal order. And I think the reason why he thinks that is to see this as being an integral part of the greater social order and good of humanity. And I think he sees that in Genesis. But it's a messy affair, because it doesn't quite, at least on the surface, neatly fit with the two kingdoms to have these three orders or three estates that he speaks about in the later part of his career.
Is marriage, in that sense, kind of standing with one foot between the other two estates, in each of the other two estates?
In a sense, except that marriage is not it's not something that comes to us from Revelation. And I think that if we're to distinguish then for Luther what the spiritual is, it's the gospel. And though the gospel is entirely complementary with marriage, marriage is something so ubiquitous across all of humanity. It doesn't depend upon our understanding of it doesn't depend upon Revelation. Revelation can, of course, deepen it, expand upon it, help us understand God's purpose in it, and so forth. But it's not itself the gospel. And I think that that's how Luther thinks through this and distinguishes marriage from spiritual and the temporal. But he does see, again, I keep coming back to this word complementarity, he sees a kind of complementarity between the three estates. He actually has this really great exposition of the matter in the relationship between Abraham, Sarah, and their various goings-on in the early part of Genesis, in the early part of the Abrahamic stories, and their relation to the temporal order, which often, actually, I think almost entirely includes Gentile kings. So here we have kings who come to their authority by some other means other than directly from divine revelation. That is, they're not called by God directly. But they still have a kind of legitimacy to their order because they bring order to our world. And he sees Sarah representing the estate of marriage and what good marriage is. And he sees Abraham as being the prophet, that is, the representing the spiritual. And so we see these three estates, lessons on these three estates being exposed to us in the book of Genesis. Very, very interesting, but it's complicated. And the matter of marriage, as I said, Luther in his early thinking puts it under temporal authority rather than distinguishing it as some kind of separate kind of kingdom or realm.
So in that realm, or in that vein, would Luther have been familiar with the concept of natural law, or would he have preferred to talk about natural revelation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that there's a great deal of evidence, maybe not a great deal, but a significant evidence that Luther did understand natural law, understood a bit of the history of natural law thinking. But it's not his priority in the early years, and that's because he thinks that talk about natural law is eclipsing the gospel. Not because of natural law being good or bad itself or being bad itself, but that the theology of his age, he believed, was too consumed with seeing natural law at the center rather than the gospel at the center. But this is not because Luther denies that there's something like natural law. And this is one of those unfortunately, it's one of those things that confessional history, that is certain types of Christian denominations doing their own version of history, ignored about, especially on the Catholic side, but also on radical or Anabaptist side of doing history, ignored about Lutheran thought in the 16th and 17th century, that they were antinomian, anti-natural law. It's just not true. We have lots of examples of that, not only from great reformers like Melanchthon, but we have them, in fact, in Luther's own writings. So, for example, we find not just allusions, but references to natural law and the natural order of things in his commentary on Genesis. But we find it elsewhere as well. It's really just not Luther's priority. Luther's priority is exposing and bringing back to life the gospel and the great gospel message. And insofar as he can do that by speaking about natural law, then he does it. But it's just not something that Luther was preoccupied with. But if you look for the evidence, it's there.
We're talking with Dr. Jarrett Carty about the political thought of Martin Luther on this Tuesday afternoon, July the 16th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly, or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly, or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly, or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly, or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hey, St. Louis, how would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the logo for the Issues Etc. Journal and Weekly Bulletin insert at issuesetc.org and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org, look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo, and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Welcome back. We're talking about the political thought of 16th century reformer Martin Luther. Dr. Jarrett Carty is our guest. He's associate professor in the Liberal Arts College of Concordia University in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, the Political Writings of Martin Luther. Stay tuned. We're going to give away two copies of that book in about 10 minutes from now. Dr. Carty, you spoke earlier about the Anabaptists, more generally kind of the radical reformers who were also coming up with their own political thought in conjunction and often in conflict with Luther's. What was the position of the radical reformers on temporal authority, and how did Luther's response center in the fact that their view of temporal authority ultimately undermined the gospel?
Yeah, well, Luther, perhaps most notoriously, opposed the Peasants' Revolt in 1525, and ever since has been the subject of lots of sometimes polemics, but sometimes long scholarly denunciations of Luther's position. But I actually think I have I have a lot of sympathy for where Luther's coming from if we understand where Luther's coming from. That is to say that Luther becomes the kind of a lightning rod, for example, socialist and communist thought in East Germany, for being the opponent of the great peasants' revolt, the great proto-communist revolution. I think we can dispense with those kinds of things now, but at the same time, I think we have to see Luther had a position, and he articulated it, and I think he was pretty consistent about it. And his problem with the Peasants' Revolt, or the revolt at Munster, and the attempt to install a new order, a new kind of Christian political order, was that it obscured the gospel, and this is how it obscured the gospel. It rendered the gospel as something we work toward. That is, that if you behave in a certain kind of way, if you organize your polity in a certain kind of way, you are meriting grace. And, of course, for Luther, this is, in fact, the central, it goes contrary to the central message of the gospel for him. And so it destroys the core of the gospel when you institute politics on the basis of gospel principles, or at least supposedly in the name of gospel principles, as in the Peasants' Revolt or as the revolt in Munster. In the early 1530s. And at the same time, he also then sees that what they also do is obscure the law and order aspect of temporal authority, how temporal authority's position is to bring us to order by use of law, by use of punishment, and so forth. And I think that he sees the fruits of that mistake, if we can speak in that way, of their mistaking of temporal order in the enormous amount of destruction that it brought. And so this is all to say that Luther, it's not that Luther had no sympathy for peasant claims for justice and their accusations of injustice against their feudal lords. In fact, Luther, even in the now often considered to be infamous writings from the Peasants' War period, Luther just outright says that the claims of the peasants are correct insofar as they've been dealt with unjustly, and that there is some claim to redress. But the way to do it is not to revolt in the name of the gospel and bring in a new political order. The solution is worse than the problem for him, because it destroys the two kingdoms.
On the other side of that, and picking up on the idea of the two kingdoms, is Luther the father of the separation of church and state as it is conceived in kind of the American context?
Yeah, that's another great question, and one that comes up certainly with that's the first thing that many of my students associate with this idea of the two kingdoms, that somehow it's some early version of that. For Luther, it's not. This would make no sense to Luther to separate church and state famously in the American version of this. And the reason is that for him, the temporal order is still an order of God. And even if we find that good temporal order in Gentile, even godless lands, it nevertheless is still an order of God. And thus for Luther, he sees them, the separation of the two kingdoms, as being something much more complementary than the kind of way in which not all American thought has been about this, but the kind in which a lot of American thought, early American founding, has been about curtailing the place of religious sectarianism. I should also say, in the context of the 16th century, not many people are subscribed to the kind of view that comes about later in the following centuries. That is, that you can have multiple confessions or multiple denominations and have a peaceful order. The prevailing idea in the early 16th century is that that would never work. You must have close to being one, if not one. And it's only in the experience of the late 16th and early 17th century that cities like Augsburg begin to realize that you can have multiple within a temporal order. And so it's not really the separation of church and state. There may be some way in which, some complicated, convoluted way in which it contributed to that line of thinking. But it's a long, long road from where Luther was to the version in the American founding. I would say that a much more insightful view of the American version of this is the situation in England in the English Reformation, in which you had an established church, and an established church that was so closely knit to the state. that it's in that situation that the separation of church and state really is born among Puritans, who, of course, bring it to America.
We were often taught this is kind of boilerplate stuff in Reformation studies when it comes to the political realm, that the prevailing idea, especially in the German territories, was whose region, his religion.
That's right.
And would Luther have been able to see past that? What would he have made of state, a formal state church as it existed after him and then, of course, still exists in parts of Europe today? What would he have made of that with a couple minutes here?
Well, I think that he would have a problem with it. And I think that it's a complicated answer, though, for Luther, because much of this was being worked out in his own lifetime, and then after his own lifetime. What are the limits to temporal authority, for example, within the church? So that Luther, in the early days of the Reformation, thought that there were some kind of emergency powers that that a prince could invoke to set up or a certain preacher in his land, or to dismiss someone. And that this was acceptable enough because it was for the sake of the gospel. I think Luther, you understand Luther if you think a little more in terms of the immediacy of the problem of the Reformation for him is in the hiding of the gospel. That is, that the gospel has to come out. And so as long as one is, as both kingdoms flourish, then we have some kind of healthy complementarity. That sometimes can mean the lines between these things are blurred, but on the other hand, for the future of the German territories up into the next century in the 30 Years' War and great confessional divides, Luther doesn't foresee that. I think that Luther, especially in the early days, foresees or expects the Reformation to be a worldwide Reformation rather than to be one that is fairly limited to certain lands in Europe, but a worldwide one that renews the entirety of the Christian Church. That's Luther's vision. It's actually the vision of all church reformers in the 16th century.
So would his coming back to background to church state again, would Luther's objection to a radical church state separation, as it's conceived in the American context, be not just philosophical, you've got it wrong, but also in the way that it's actually been enacted, the way it's actually been manifest in laws, in the social structure of the American context?
I think so, yeah. I think that that's true. From Luther's perspective, there's something wrong here. And it may be the case that we can say, well, Luther, this is better. We might be able to say that. And I'm sure that there are listeners who could argue that very well and argue that as Christians very well. But for Luther, there's something problematic about it. And it has the danger of obscuring the gospel and obscuring the purpose of temporal government. And so the idea that, and there is this idea, in fact, there was a letter to the editor in the paper that I read daily to this very effect, that somehow or another religion is entirely destructive of the political order. And that's a kind of modern view that just is complete nonsense in the 16th century. It's entirely the opposite for Luther, that there would be a complementarity between the life of faith and the wellness of the political social order. And that's something curiously opposite in our age. And I think that, perhaps Luther, we can fault Luther for not anticipating some of the great things that can come about in the modern age of and modern political orders. On the other hand, we can also fault ourselves for following that idea a little too easily these days, that somehow or another the religious truths are destructive of the political social order, or are almost always destructive of the political order, and we have to curb them, we have to shove them away. This makes no sense in the 16th century.
All right, well, let's pick up there on the other side of the break. We're going to have 10 more minutes with Dr. Jarrett Carty talking about the political thought of Martin Luther in hour two of Issues Etc. We'll pick up right there, that gulf between us and Luther today. You're listening to Issues Etc. live this Tuesday afternoon. It's the 16th of July. I'm Todd Wilkin, the political thought of Martin Luther, with Dr. Jarrett Carty, associate professor in the Liberal Arts College of Concordia University in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, and author of the Issues Etc. book of the month for July, Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, The Political Writings of Martin Luther. We're going to take a break. Callers number 5 and 6 during this break, callers number 5 and 6 during this break, will receive a copy of the book Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, The Political Writings of Martin Luther. 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE. Callers 5 and 6 will get a copy of Divine Kingdom, Holy Order. Call during this break. 877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE.
Lutheranism in the Public Square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that Logia, a journal of Lutheran theology, sells CDs and audio downloads of teachings by some of the top Lutheran theologians in the country? Check out Logia's 99-cent download of the month at shop.logia.org. Shop.logia.org. You'll also find books published by Luther Academy and, of course, the quarterly Logia Journal at shop.logia.org. Continuing education for the confessional Lutheran, shop.logia.org.
What makes Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois so special? Our new members talk about the family atmosphere, the welcoming people, and the outstanding music. But most importantly, you'll be confronted with your sin and comforted with the assurance that Jesus has removed that sin so that you can live each day as His baptized and forgiven child. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is at 612 North State Street in Freeburg, Illinois. Sunday worship is at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible classes at 10:20 a.m. Call 618-539-5664.
South Africa.
China.
Germany.
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world? India.
Sweden.
Egypt. France.
Turkey.
Japan.
Australia.
Canada.
United Kingdom.
Hong Kong.
Austria.
Finland.
Malaysia.
Singapore.
Bulgaria.
Korea.
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines.
Mexico.
Spain.
New Zealand.
Kuwait.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Tuesday afternoon, July the 16th. Another 10 minutes in our conversation on the political thought of Martin Luther with Dr. Jarrett Carty. After that, Pastor Tom Baker joins us. We'll be teaching a Sunday school lesson today. Luke chapter 10, beginning at verse 25, the famous parable of the Good Samaritan. Pastor Tom Baker of Law and Gospel in about 10 minutes here on Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. journal is out, and I've written an article that I've been waiting to write for a long time. It was years and years ago that I heard a fellow Lutheran pastor, when asked the question, is Jesus the only way of salvation? He kind of very qualified answer. It was, well, yes, for us. Is there any other way of salvation? Well, maybe. We don't know. God can do anything. Is that true? Is God's omnipotence a reason to question whether or not Jesus is the only way of salvation? Well, God can do anything He wants to. Maybe He can save people other ways. What does Scripture actually teach about what God can and cannot do and what God has done in Jesus Christ? I answer those questions in an article written for the Issues Etc. journal called What God Cannot Do. You can subscribe to the journal absolutely free at our website, issuesetc.org. The big red button is there. Click on that, and you will enter your email address absolutely free. You are then subscribed to the Issues Etc. journal. Also, the Wittenberg Trail features Pastor John Fraser, his journey from introspection to the Lutheran Reformation. issuesetc.org. Look for the big red button. Enter your email address. Dr. Jarrett Carty is our guest. We're talking about the political thought of Martin Luther. Dr. Carty, before the break, you talked about that kind of divide that exists between us today, the way we think about temporal authority and the way Luther thought about it. Was representative constitutional democracy even in Luther's political vocabulary?
No, it wasn't. By and large, it's not. That's right. However, he is, as I said earlier about his respect for the classics, he's mindful that there are lots of wiser people than him on how to run a city. And Luther, actually, I think if we look at writings to his writings on education and on schooling, we see that Luther's actually, when he puts his mind to it, has got a lot more to say than we might think. It's just that his preoccupation is the restoring the purity of the gospel. And this meant that maybe Luther had a lot more to say about something like some early version of representative government, but it really wasn't. It really wasn't his preoccupation. This was that would be a kind of sideshow to what what was his calling for his career, and that is the restoration of the purity of the gospel.
How do you respond to one of the biggest accusations against Luther politically, and that is that he unwittingly laid the foundation for the rise of fascism in Western Europe, and in particular for National Socialism?
Yeah, that of course is something that in the aftermath of the Second World War and the horrors of the Third Reich in the Second World War, lots of people asked on the German, English, and of course across the world, how did this happen? And we look into the Nazi regime. They appropriated all sorts of German people as being proto-Nazis, Luther being one of them. The problem with the general view, the general accusation of Luther made against Luther, is that he's pro-absolutism, meaning that he's pro-temporal order, unquestioned obedience, and no matter what they say, we do. The problem with that view is that, first of all, it's not true of Luther himself. Of first and second generation reformers, Luther is actually one of the strongest on some kind of grounds for resistance in comparison to first and second generation reformers, including Calvin. The other problem with that is, by the standard of what we call absolutism in our day and age, virtually everyone in the 16th century is. So to accuse Luther of not being mindful enough to know the things that come about in the following centuries, it's really not unfair, because we don't bring that to a whole lot of other people in his time. And so I really don't think that Luther is that kind of father of absolutism. Now, as far as the specifically National Socialist, Luther would find almost all of that abhorrent. And part of the accusation comes from the absolutism, but a small part of it also comes from Luther's unfortunate writings on Jews. I say unfortunate because I don't think actually Luther was quite consistent in especially his late diatribe against the Jews. And I don't think it's quite consistent at all with his theology. This is actually a book that's written by Eric Rich, a senior Luther scholar, who says that in his latest book on Luther's anti-Semitism, simply called, says that it's just not consistent. Luther was inconsistent with the core of his theology, and I think that that's true. So unfortunately, Luther was part of a very typical, unfortunately far too typical, anti-Semitism of the early modern period, but it doesn't make him a Nazi. And I think that delving into the record of National Socialism, we find, in fact, quite a bit of arm's length, keeping their distance, Nazis that is, keeping their distance from the Lutheran Church, even though we, of course, find confessions that became Nazified. I think we find that at the end of the day, many Nazis wanted to keep Christian churches far away because there were great moral questions that one could ask about the regime. And like I said, on Luther's standards, virtually everything about the Third Reich would have been abhorrent to him.
In a general sense, what is the biggest misconception you think that the theological descendants of Lutherans, have about his two-kingdom theology? What's their biggest misconception today that you would correct?
I think that this is not a question I don't think I'm quite well equipped to answer, because so much of my world is just looking into the 16th century and not a whole lot about and certainly not about Lutheran history. I think that I'll agree with some German scholarship and American scholarship in the last little while that have said that you really have to understand this distinction of law and gospel in Luther to get Luther straight. And it's too easy to boil down the two kingdoms to something very facile as being church and state. And so I think that that's one of the ways in which Luther is misunderstood. I think one of the ways for myself that I find I've discovered in Luther, although I guess I half expected it going in, was how rich the Bible is, how one has to take
take one's time with the Bible. There is a simplicity to the message of the gospel. I'm not saying that there isn't, but at the same time, the richness of the Bible and what the Bible means to us, what lessons it can teach us, is not something one just simply gets with a brief sitting and looking up a few passages. That it takes a good deal of time to think it through, to read it through, and to behold its depth. And I think that that's a lesson that I've got out of Luther, and a misunderstanding that, or at least a clarification I've gotten from him, is that these characters from, like Luther, from these ages past, where the Bible was such an enormous cultural, civilization, spiritual force for them, is not something simple. It's complicated, and it's wonderful to read that and to see that at work in Luther.
Finally, then, what about the notion, and it's often attributed or carried around by Lutherans, that his view of two kingdoms is essentially you've got the one that is a necessary good and the other one that's a necessary evil. The church is a necessary good, but government, human government, is a necessary evil. Very popular in the American context today to view government as a necessary evil. Would Luther have concurred?
Yeah, well, there's a problem with putting it that way. On the one hand, we can find we could come up with evidence to support that argument that government is a necessary evil. Luther and many reformers like him, and in fact, many medieval sources like him describe government as being there for the sake of curbing sin, and so therefore, if there were no sin, there'd be no government. Of course, there's something true about that. That is, government would radically change. It would seem to be quite different if there was no sin. But on the other hand, that view is betrayed by so much of Luther's own words. He has nothing but the highest praise for temporal order in virtually any time he talks about it. That it's the greatest gift that God has given us, aside from revelation in the gospel. It's the greatest gift that He's given the world. This does not sound like the necessary evil. And so his constant injunction to honor, not just to grudgingly obey, but to honor political authority, is to honor God, because it's to honor the order that God has given the universe. And so I think that for Luther, yeah, it curbs sin, but it's something more akin to how we would see, say, the laws of nature at work. That is to say that we can't but have anything else than this, and this is to the glory of God. It's the order of creation and how we act it out. Our sin may disrupt that. Our sin may somehow corrupt it, but at the same time, essentially, it is a gift of God worthy of honor and respect.
So finally, with 1 minute, if we fail to see Luther's understanding of temporal order, temporal government, as a divine gift, we will, in essence, fail to understand Luther's political thought.
I think that's true. That's right. I think that's true. And I think that it's while we could live our lives perhaps without reading Luther on temporal authority and have a good go of it, at the same time, it's a good corrective for us. That is to see where we have bring our own prejudices to our own contemporary age that we need some self-reflection upon.
Dr. Jarrett Cardy is Associate Professor in the Liberal Arts College of Concordia University in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. He has authored the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July called Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, The Political Writings of Martin Luther. You really want to understand Luther when it comes to the gift of this divine order that he calls government, temporal government, and understand how he sees God behind the governing of all human affairs. And to understand the right relationship between temporal government and Christ's rule in the church through the means of grace and the forgiveness of sins, this is the book for you, Divine Kingdom, Holy Order, The Political Writings of Martin Luther. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order Divine Kingdom, Holy Order. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. 3040. Dr. Cardy, thank you very much for being our guest.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
When we come back, the parable of the Good Samaritan, Pastor Tom Baker will be our guest.
Those beautiful notes were just the beginning of We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God, Concordia Publishing House's debut CD collection from Pastor Stephen Starkey, one of the most significant Lutheran hymn writers of our time. For a limited time, save 10% when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran thought, Lutheran substance, Lutheran music, brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.
Would you like to help your son or daughter achieve their maximum athletic potential? Hi, this is Jeff Schwarz, General Manager of Lutheran Public Radio. My friend, fellow parishioner, and certified athletic trainer, Kevin Reisick, is the owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. Arch Fitness specializes in sports performance training for middle school to collegiate level athletes. For more information, call Kevin at 618-670-6952. 618-670-6952.
Luther had Wartburg. We have Collinsville. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. What does this mean? We want to hear from you. Why do you listen? How has it helped you? What are your favorite topics? Who are your favorite guests? And what makes Issues Etc. unique? Please leave your thoughts about this worldwide outreach on the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Be sure to give us your first name and tell us where you're from. Issues Etc. What does this mean? 618-223-8382.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper, every service, every Sunday, and Wednesdays too, preaching Christ crucified and risen. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is, 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri, or find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.